Welcome, 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 geeks and nerds, girls and boys, to a brand new episode of Geek to Me Radio, New Year's Eve edition. Tonight, we have Victor Gishler talking about the adaptation of his novel Gun Monkeys to the new movie starring Pierce Brosnan and Fast Charlie. After that, we'll chat with Fabian Nicieza about his new cable miniseries, plus some other good tidbits. All that and more, stand by.
We're talking TV, comics and movies, and video games. And if you don't know, Star Trek from Star Wars, we'll try to explain. There are 12 doctors, 4 Hogwarts houses, 1 ring rules and more.
And for those of you, I'm not sure if you're driving around the greater St. Louis area this time of night on New Year's Eve in St. Louis, but wherever you're listening from right now, I thank you, be it after the fact, online, or live on the radio. We have a full show. We're barely going to be able to squeeze this all in within an hour, so let's jump to it. Right now, we're talking with writer Victor Gishler. It's been a while since we've had him on our show. Last time we had him on, he was talking about the Spirits of Vengeance one-shot he did for Marvel. Now, with this new movie coming out starring Pierce Brosnan, I figured we'd have him back on to talk about his original book on which it's based. Victor, thanks for your time today.
Great. Great to be speaking with you again.
When you look at books, I always talk to authors and I'm always fascinated because one of the questions, especially with things being optioned by Netflix and Amazon and the Hollywood studios, when they write a book, do they have anyone in mind for who would play the role? So when you first wrote Gun Monkeys, was there any idea that if this is optioned, here's who I'd like to play who?
I envisioned an actor, but this is a 20 plus year old book. So anybody I envisioned while writing it is not necessarily, going to make any difference when they finally get around to it. I had, for whatever reason, I had Miller's Crossing fresh on my mind, and I just saw Gabriel Byrne as Charlie Swift, and so I kind of because also his demeanor in Miller's Crossing is a little bit, similar to the novel version of Charlie Swift. So I kind of envisioned him, but I knew that when it got to be time for these people to go out and cast this thing, they want the right person for the job. They want the guy who not only fits the role, fits the character, but there's just some very realistic financing concerns and things like that. And they got to get the right guy for the part, but they got to get a guy who is going to make the financing people say, yeah, that's a good bet. We want to invest in that.
Right.
And so Pierce Brosnan, I think, fits the bill.
Yeah. I mean, just when you look at the body of work he's done, I'm actually going back and doing a rewatch of Remington Steele now on Amazon. And then, the James Bond movies. And even after that, ones like After the Sunset and the Tailor of Panama and things like that he's done. This seems like for this particular project, he's right in his element. Have you, what was the process with you with filming? Did they have you look at any of the early footage or anything like that? Did they keep consulting with you all the way through?
Well, they showed me a rough cut just as a courtesy. But when I went out to the film debuted at the Mill Valley Film Festival in California. And they were very kindly had me up on the stage with the director and some Phil Eisler, who did the music, and a couple of other guys. And because that was during the strike.
Ah.
So the stars couldn't be there. So they had other people. They had the director and that other people could be there. And as a courtesy, they had me up. And I was asked about, the book and being turned into a film and things like that. And I said to them what I'll say to you, which is I gave myself permission to be out of the to be out of it. Just let these professional people do what they needed to do to make a film. They didn't need me. There were some times that, I mean, there were a number of producers on the project, and the producer that I talked the most with was a gentleman named Dan Grobnik, and he kept me in the loop as best he could. He'd call once in a while, let me know how things were going and how casting was going. But really, I just let them, I mean, I just let them do it. I let them do it. I have one, the only possible thing I can claim as a contribution, other than originally, you know, writing the novel in the first place. Mm-hmm. The producer called me up. He said, we are having trouble because we'll send the script. You know, you got to go through like a manager or an agent before you get to somebody like Pierce Brosnan. And they showed it to other actors, and some manager looked at the script, and the original title is Gun Monkeys.
Right.
And he just turned up his nose and said, "Gun Monkeys? So you want my client to be a monkey? What is it you want? What is what?" And for some reason, that title was not working. And the producer called me up and said, "This title, it seems to be putting people off. Not regular people, but, you know, like these manager agent types. Can you think of another title?" And I said, "Well, his name is Charlie Swift. So how about Fast Charlie? Because, you know, his last name is Swift. He fights, his nemesis is a guy named Lloyd Mercury. And, you know, when I wrote the novel, I wanted the names to mean something, even if the reader didn't care. You know, for me, I wanted these names to mean something. So I said, why don't you call it Fast Charlie? And even if you don't end up calling it Fast Charlie, when you film it, at least you can call it Fast Charlie for now. And these managers won't object to that." And it ended up sticking. And that was the not only the title of the film, but they retitled the book to go with, to coincide with the film.
I saw that. I saw that there was I think you posted on your Instagram page, there was a new release of the book that's out, and it's titled that. And I was kind of wondering if that was just to help promote the movie, but now I know the actual reason.
Well, and also because, what better advertisement could there be for the book and the film and having, you know, Pierce Brosnan, you know, you're not going to put my ugly mug on the front of the book. Let's get a handsome guy on the front of there and see if we can sell a few copies. Sure. So I had no objection. I heard that when they approached J.K. Rowling to make the Harry Potter movies, that J.K. Rowling insisted on, "Well, I want to be able to veto who you cast and things like that." I'm not J.K. Rowling. I don't have her sales. I don't have her power. You know, I am just said, you know what? I'm going to step back. You want to ask my opinion on something, I'll be happy to share with you. But you guys go make a movie. You're the professionals. Have at it.
And with this one, with Fast Charlie, I know that you mentioned that, you know, the strike was happening during this time. And during the production at all, did you get to actually meet with Pierce Brosnan and talk to him? How was that?
No, it would have been nice to, when I went out to Mill Valley for the premiere, it would have been nice to meet him, but he just, you know, no actors were not allowed to do any sort of publicity or anything. So, but I got to meet the director, Phil Noyce, really nice guy, very enthusiastic about the film. He seems like the kind of director that when he's involved in a project, he likes the project, that he likes it. He wants to do it. He's eager about it. And I really appreciated that. I never got the feeling that Phil Noyce was phoning it in to get a paycheck or anything like that. He was working on something that he was passionate about, and I really appreciated that. But I didn't get to meet Pierce Brosnan, so maybe they'll do a sequel, and I'll go see him on the sequel.
There you go. And this is such the indie movies, because we're seeing, you know, it's all over the news, some of these big budget blockbusters that are coming out are just not doing well. The audience isn't quite there for it anymore, whatever you want to ascribe the reason being. But I feel like I've seen in the past 2 years, especially, a lot of smaller independent films that I just adore. Is this one of those things where you mentioned earlier, this film had been optioned by a couple other people and it obviously didn't go through. Is there something that draws you to those types of projects as well? Or is that just happened to be the happy coincidence that it's the smaller production companies that end up optioning your books?
You know, I don't know because maybe the books they're optioning are hit that sweet spot of being compelling stories with interesting characters, but also contained enough where they can do a smaller budget thing or an independent thing. I mean, I've written fantasy novels too, where if you tried to make those into movies or TV shows, we're talking Game of Thrones budgets. And so people might read those and think, well, these are great, but it's going to cost us $1 billion to do this.
Right.
Whereas, you know, these other things, we can control it. We can contain it. It's doable. You know, and that's fine. That's, you know, I'm happy if these people find anything that they like about, you know, what something I've written and then want to do something with it. That's flattering, and I'm happy to roll along with it.
And we've talked to other authors on the show before, like we had Brad Meltzer, who's kind of like what you just said. He writes fantasy, he writes crime, he writes different things like that. Do you find yourself drawn more to one? Is it easier for you as a writer to lose yourself in one genre versus another for you, or is it all pretty much the same?
I feel like I can sort of run out of steam on something.
Okay.
I need to change. I mean, I needed a change from crime. I'd written some crime novels, and they were sort of well-received in certain circles, but they weren't bestsellers or anything. You know, so I was like, well, you know, when I grew up, I really liked fantasy. I like, you know, swords and stuff like that. I'm going to try that. And I tried that. And then I found that after writing a lot of that, I was offered a chance to write a Western.
Ooh.
Under a pseudonym. So I wrote a Western under the name Nate Morgan. And it was like, cool. It was like, oh, it's nice to do guns again, because I've been doing swords and spells. Now I'm back to guns. And, you know, I can just, it's a whole different bunch of toys. It's a different set of toys, you know? And I'm like, oh, I'm going to play with these toys for a while. And now I'm sort of re-energized, and I don't want to brag too much, but I wrote my very first Western that was ever published. I got a Spur Award.
Oh, nice. Very cool.
And I got that call. They said, you just got a Spur Award. I'm like, you're kidding. And I got my butt out to South Dakota to accept it. And while I was out there, you know, I took my son and we saw Mount Rushmore and made a trip out of it and everything. So just that I can switch gears is energizing. You know, when I get tired of guns and horses and lassos, I'll go back to swords and wizards. And then if I get tired of that, I need a break. I don't know. Maybe I'll do spaceships, or maybe I'll do a romantic comedy, or I don't know. But it's nice to be able to get a new set of toys, and then that'll re-energize me a little bit.
As someone like myself who's a layman, I would assume that fantasy, and again, I'm guessing here just based on my limited knowledge, would be somewhat easier to write than a Western, where I feel like a Western, people want details like, well, they wouldn't have had that gun in 1886, or, well, this is the kind of horse that was in South Dakota during this time period because of the migration of the Native Americans at that time. Did you find that there's a little more research involved or necessary, or is it kind of the same across the board for you?
Well, I mean, what you're saying is true, but then again, it's easier in some ways, because in a fantasy world, I have to make up everything.
Yeah.
In a Western, you know, Kansas already exists. You know, Texas already. I just go look up some stuff in Texas and towns. I don't have to explain to my reader where Idaho is. I mean, it exists already. So, on the one hand, yeah, I got to do some research. And I gotta check up on things to make sure I'm representing the region properly, or that my protagonist isn't using a gun that wasn't invented yet or something, you know. So I do have to put my due diligence into that, but I don't have to make up a world from soup to nuts like I do with a fantasy novel.
Right.
From the ground up.
Right. And going back to Fast Charlie, if you can't talk about this, I understand. I'm just curious because you mentioned it and I wanted to circle back. You mentioned that it had been optioned by a couple other studios in the past. Obviously, we didn't get a movie then. Was it something that they take the idea and then the time lapses and they don't do it, so the rights revert back to you to do with what you want? How does that work, or do you not want to speak about that?
It's just about timing and the right puzzle pieces all coming together in the right place and time, and it finally happened, you know, and it took a while, it wasn't all good news, you know. There were things that happened along the way that were not awesome, but I'm not going to dwell on those because it ended up being a film, and you know, lots of books are optioned, but it's only a small percentage of them that get to actually be a film. So I'm not going to, you know, dwell on maybe the short list of things that weren't ideal.
Right.
And instead focus on the much larger list of stuff that's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, the woman from Firefly is in my movie. That's awesome. I mean, you know, just stuff like that, you know, is where I'm going to focus energy.
Yeah, and that's probably a healthier way to live life too, I think, in that instance.
Well, you know what? If I could just talk about my mental health.
Sure.
I'm not telling a secret when I say, because the director, Phil Noyce, he tells these in his interviews, he tells these stories. So I was asked when I was being interviewed on stage, sitting right next to Phil Noyce at the premiere, they said, how does it feel to have your book made into a movie? I bet it feels great. And I said, without even kind of thinking, I said, it felt great at first. But then it became a source of anxiety.
Huh.
Because they got to filming. They had Pierce Brosnan, they had the crew down there, they had the director down there, they got them all down there in New Orleans ready to go 4 days before filming. They lose a giant chunk of the funding. It just goes away.
Ooh.
And they said, oh, we're going to film in February. Oh, no, we're not going to film in March. Maybe, oh, well, maybe we're going to film in April. And I started getting anxious, like, oh my God, is this going to happen? And it became, instead of it being like this great thing that's happening, it was like a great thing that was maybe going to be taken away.
Yeah, that,
you know,
makes sense.
I was like, oh, I'm having, this is great. It's like if you walk into your own birthday party and somebody comes in and takes the cake and all the presents and walks out and says, never mind, you're not going to have a birthday party. And it's
yeah.
Like, yeah, that would suck. And I thought, this is it. This is it. My birthday party is over. And so it became a source of anxiety. And then when it finally did happen, I just had to take like this deep breath, and my wife had to remind me, like, you know, this is good. We should go out to Mill Valley and to the premiere and see it. And I'm just like, should we? I mean, I guess. And it took a while for me to feel good and happy about it again, because it was just this source of stress.
And that's fascinating. I'm glad you said that, because a lot of people, they see the, you know, it's that meme where you see people's success and it's the iceberg sticking out of the water and you don't see all the stuff under the water. That's the tension, the hard work it took to get there, the setbacks and everything like that. So what you've described is kind of like that iceberg meme. And I'm glad that you said that, because a lot of people, I don't think, associate someone's success with negative feelings sometimes. So thank you for that. Thank you for that honesty.
Well, and I got to tell you, and nobody out there should feel sorry for me, because it worked out.
Yeah, clearly.
So I am not trying to say poor me. I'm just saying it wasn't
a
smooth road, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's great, because like I said, you know, people are opening up more about mental health, and I think it what you've just said will make someone else feel like, oh, you know what, I feel like that, so I'm not alone in feeling that way. That's good. So yeah, I appreciate that very much. And one last question before I let you go, because I told you I'd only keep you for a little bit. I'm curious. You mentioned, you know, if there is a sequel, would that be something that, well, here's another book. Is there like a Charlie Swift series, or would that be something that they've got the rights now, they can do whatever they want with the sequel, kind of like they did with the Quiet Place 2? How would that work out for you?
You know, another thing that Phil Noyce mentioned when we were all in Mill Valley is that they had been contacted by somebody about a TV series for Fast Charlie. Now, I don't know who that was or how serious it was or anything. I flat out don't know. But they can pick up that ball and run as far and as fast with it as they like. And I will just pat them on the back and say, good job, fellas. do what you can do. Make hay while the sun shines.
Yeah. Hopefully the executive producer credit or something like that, if they do a series, I would think, for you.
That'd be fine. I would take that.
And I guess the sales, I think what you printed with that new cover with him on there, I guess there's renewed interest in the book too, which is always nice for an author to have, you know, any interest at all, but renewed interest in a book you previously had written must be great.
It's kind of cool because, after 20 years, I mean, people would still pick up a copy once in a while. The good thing about Amazon is, I mean, it's hard to walk. You couldn't walk into a Barnes & Noble and find a copy of the book. It's a 20-year-old book. Mm-hmm. But Amazon.com keeps things alive. You know, people were still buying a copy here and there. Now it's sort of got a new lease on life, I guess. And I would love to think people would find the book and give it a chance. And maybe you see the movie and you read the book and compare and contrast, see what they left out. You know, that might be fun, but it's nice that the book Hard Case Crime is the publisher, and they're kind of the perfect publisher to bring this out because it's their kind of book. So I'm glad it found a home with Hard Case Crime.
I'm in my studio right now. And I'm looking across the room here. I've got my row of my original Ian Fleming Bond novels, and I think about how different those novels are from the movie treatment. So I said the last question was the last question, but my last question is, if someone's familiar with the book, are they going to be thrown for a loop like Moonraker or something where that's completely different, or does it follow along pretty well?
You're going to see, if somebody has read the book and has a good memory of the book, because like I said, it's 20 years old, you're going to see that it's obviously, the movie is obviously based on the book. It's clearly the same plot, the same characters, the same situation. But it's all been very streamlined. They took just what they needed from the book, and anything that was extra stuff, they just left it, and they just used the core necessary stuff from the book. Because it's a really trim, slim 90-minute movie. It's not a giant Lord of the Rings kind of movie. It's right. Just a quick 90-minute movie, and I think it's a good companion. I think it's a good adaptation. But if you go and read the book, you're going to get a lot of new stuff that didn't make it into the film.
And if people do want to get the book, you suggest buying it. Obviously, it's hard to find in bookstores because we always recommend support your local bookstore. But do you have a website where people can go visit you and then see your novels, pick up some of your other stuff directly from the website, or is it all online retail mostly?
I have a website that people can come find out about me, but I leave it to the bookstores and Amazon and those people to actually sell the books. Since it is a new book, if you want to support your local bookstore, I would absolutely tell you to do that. Walk into your local bookstore, and if they don't have it, they can order it, have it in a couple of days. Or if you just can't stand it and you have to have it immediately, you know, just go on Amazon and get it on for your Kindle.
Perfect. And I mentioned you are on Twitter and Instagram. It's just at Victor Gishler, correct?
That's correct.
Very cool. And if you're listening to this after the fact, scroll down to the bottom of the page and you can, we'll have a link to Victor's website in our show notes. Victor Gishler, I greatly appreciate your time. Thanks for being on and happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you too. And it was good. And I'll talk to you again in 20 years when they make the next movie.
But hopefully not that long. We'll see.
All right. Take care.
Big thanks to Victor Gishler for making the time. If you haven't checked out Fast Charlie on streaming platforms, make sure you do so. It's a great film. We want to make sure we tell you quickly about our official comic book sponsor, Bugs Comics and Games. They've been with us for quite a while now, and if you've not been out there, you're missing out on a great place to buy comics. We're about to talk to Fabian Nicieza about his new Cable miniseries coming out in January. Head out to Bugs, let Larry know, hey, I want to put that Cable miniseries on my pull list. Make sure you start a pull list, and make sure you join the Avengers Club, because you'll start saving money automatically every time you buy comics. Instead of paying full price, why do that? Join the Avengers Club, get a discount on your new issues, back issues, toys, games, bag boards, hobby stuff, whatever it is you're getting there at bugs, comics, and games. Save some money while you enjoy your hobby. Just chat with Larry, tell him Geek to Me Radio sent you, and he will make sure that you are in the know about everything you need to know, and of course, make sure you're saving money everywhere you can. Bugs, Comics, and Games, give their Facebook page a like, and of course, follow them on Instagram, Bugs, Comics, and Games. Very proud to have them as our official comic book sponsor here on Geek to Me Radio. Our next guest has been on the show before, and we've got him again talking about his new series. Let's dive in. We're joined once again by author, writer, Fabian Nicieza. We had him on last time. It was one of my favorite shows. We talked about all the advertising and marketing that Marvel Comics put out when he was in charge of that, and it was a great deal of fun. We had a lot of response to it. And now we're going to talk about the new Cable miniseries, which should hit your local comic book store shelf January 17th. So make sure to get a pre-order in now. Let your people know that you want it so they can add it to your pull list. Fabian, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, James?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining me on New Year's Eve and your birthday. Happy birthday, by the way.
Thank you very much. I am turning 39 years young again.
So with a New Year's Eve birthday, I guess it's kind of fun because you always have a party to go to.
Now, it was fun when I was growing up, that's for sure. And it was certainly fun when I was a teenager and in college. But it's been a lot less fun as an adult. A lot less fun, you know, once you have kids and et cetera, et cetera. And my wife and I aren't giant party goers, so we don't tend to go to New Year's Eve parties that often. So the irony is, the older I get, the more indifferent I am to it. Like, you know, the lazier I am to it. Like,
right.
My wife and I have been going to bed before midnight now for a few years. You know, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. It's just the turning of the clock is what it amounts to.
Yeah, my wife and I are the same way, because I'm kind of like, I'm a night owl by nature. And usually she's like, okay, wake me up when it's New Year's Eve, because she goes to sleep at like 8 o'clock, and I'm usually staying up till to see the ball drop or whatever. But it's always fun.
Yeah, it's just like with anything, it you can make something of it every single year, and that's wonderful. Have fun, but the other side of the coin is it's the same thing every year. So
right.
It's just, you know, the other side of it is just it's the expectancy. It just comes around. What it really means is that another, for me especially, New Year's, because it's my birthday, it's like another cycle around the sun means one less cycle coming up in
yeah.
the future.
Yeah, it's kind of odd. We reach that apex where it's like, oh, now there's less of those to look forward to, which...
Oh, yeah, no, no. Unless I live to 124, there's a lot less, because I'm on the other side of half of having lived my life.
Right. It's so, and who knows, with life expectancy, and we talked off air about your childlike mindset, maybe you will live to be 124.
They're it could be, yes.
You never know.
Yes. Both my parents lived to be older, and neither one of them were as immature as I am, so maybe that combination will keep me percolating to 110, 115, around there. So.
That'll be what pushes you over the edge, exactly. It's always great to see your name on a comic book, because obviously when I grew up reading comics, you were like red hot, and it's interesting because I just saw Roy Thomas's Facebook page post a thing of the highest published authors, like the people who wrote the most number of stories, and they broke it down by stories and pages, and you're up in the top like 15 with names like Roy Thomas, Stan Lee, Chuck Dixon, a lot of people who wrote massive stories, and it's impressive that you're on that list. That's got to be very pleasing, I would think. Did you see the list? Do you have any thoughts on it?
I've seen different ones at different times. I never took stock of it, and I should have. Like, Dan Slott counts every page he writes, and I never did. And in hindsight, I regret that, because then I never know exactly what's accurate and what's not. And it's almost impossible for me to go back and look at everything and try to catalog everything. So I have seen it. I know I wrote a lot. I have. The irony is that I really stepped away from comics as my main source of income almost 20 years ago at this point. So since 2008 or so, 2010, I really haven't written many comics. My thing when I look at those kinds of things, it's always what I think I saw they missed, you know,
like, right.
I know they're not counting custom comics that I've done, and there's a couple hundred pages minimum of that I've done for Marvel and DC, probably more than that, probably three to 400 pages worth of custom comics work I've done for Marvel and DC. They don't count that, you know, that kind of stuff. I'm not surprised. I mean, it feels good in more than anything, it feels good being listed among people like that, like Roy Thomas and Chuck Dixon and Stan Lee and Jerry Conway and guys I respect tremendously, because they, what I've always respected are the hardworking month-to-month guys, more so than the hot, cool, special project that deconstructs your favorite superhero,
right,
and makes them a prostitute kind of thing. That kind of stuff bores me, and I prefer that plug to its dictuitive aspect of the industry in that capacity. So I'll look in the early 90s, or very early 90s, a very, very popular through the 70s and 80s comic book creator called me the Jerry Conway of the 90s.
Oh, wow.
Thinking that it was an insult to me.
And
I laughed because it was like a tremendous compliment.
Right.
Me. You know, I don't have to like everything Jerry Conway wrote to respect the living daylights out of the fact that Jerry Conway was writing monthly comics for decades since he was like 17, 18 years old, you know. So being in that grouping is kind of cool.
And when you said someone called you that, my reaction was, oh, wow, because what a compliment. The guy's written Spider-Man, Batman. He's done all sorts of stories. He's done stuff that got adapted to animation. So, yeah, I'm kind of scratching my head on how that can be an insult myself.
Yeah, but because they're thinking that, because their view is very myopic, because they're hot then or hot during the decade. There's a real tendency in the industry to disparage anything that came before you as a way of pumping yourself up. You know, and I think that's part and parcel of it. I probably was a snarky, arrogant ass when I was in my 20s and early 30s, and I probably ragged on some of the previous generation. I got over that stupidity real quick. You know, the more work I did, the more I respected the work that came before me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm at the point now in my life and in my career where anybody who works hard as a freelance writer across different platforms throughout decades is truly a hardworking professional writer, period. You know?
Right. And I know we didn't get a chance to talk about it before we get to Cable. I saw you last at Terrificon, I think it was 2022, 2 years ago now, and your Juggernaut series was ongoing, and I had you sign the big promo poster. I get you and Ron to both sign the promo poster for me, but I didn't get a chance to tell you that was an amazing miniseries. I absolutely adored it.
I appreciate it. I enjoyed it tremendously, getting to work with an artist as good as Ron, who I've known for so long and whose work has just always evolved in really fascinating, exciting ways. As I was working on the Cable miniseries now, I just realized I've actually been pretty lucky in that I've gotten to work, the very little amount of comic book work I do now, I've really gotten to work with artists I've either known a long time and respect, or artists that I never worked with or don't know that well, but whose work I find perfectly suited to the kind of writing I like to do. And Ron is certainly one of those. And now Scott Eaton on Cable is another one. There is an absolute difference in the generational styles of artists. There is an absolute difference in the tone among and between different superhero books put out by Marvel and DC right now. I'm a huge believer in as a publishing program, you need to have a wide diversity in not only talent, but in the tone and styles of books you choose to do.
Mm-hmm.
I am still of the disposition that when I'm writing a Marvel or a DC superhero book, I want it to be crunchy fun, you know? So I want artists who know how to draw crunchy fun. I don't need artists who know how to draw someone staring out a window for 9 panels. That's not what I'm writing. You know,
right.
I want an artist that can draw me a big old huge 2/3 panel page with gigantic Kirby tech equipment and the great gargoyle coming out from behind a piece of equipment. That's what I want, you know? And I've been really lucky in the limited amount of superhero work I've done for Marvel. I get to work with Ron Garney. I get to work with Paco Medina. I get to now work with Scott Eaton. It's a lot of fun.
And this is a character that you've continued to visit. It's not like you know, did him in New Mutants and X-Force and then, okay, I'm not visiting that character again. So you've gotten to play with Cable. on and off, but this is a different story. He's teaming up with his younger self, Nate Gray.
This is young Cable. This is Nate Gray. This is Cable at age 15.
Oh, so it's not. I saw Nate and I was thinking, oh, this is Nate Gray.
The way I differentiated it even in script is between Cable and Nate. I call him Nate. Otherwise, I don't want to call him young Cable in my script. You know, that's scary shades of Kid Nova from the debut of New Warriors 30 years ago. This is the younger version of the character that Jerry Dugan introduced in a 12 issue series that he had. And then he went back to the future, and apparently in the ongoing Krakoa and Orcus storyline in the mainstream books, he's come back. So when they called me up to see if I was interested, I just asked a few questions. Where's young Nate? Because I knew they had done this miniseries, but I hadn't read it at the time. And what's Cable's role in the big crossover? So we hashed all that out and talked it all out, and it really made a lot of sense to start my storyline by picking up on story threads that are going on in the main books. And in that capacity, young Nate has been kidnapped by Orcus. So it made a lot of sense for me to start my book with Cable trying to rescue young Nate from Orcus. And then we go on a kind of an offshoot branching adventure from there. And the adventure is set in present continuity, but it's taking place kind of parallel to the events going on in the main X books.
But this isn't something you'd have to read the main X books to get, like some of the offshoots of the newest Secret Wars they just came out with a couple of years ago. You had to kind of, well, why is this happening, and stuff with the Ultimates and things like that they've done in the past. This is something you can read this and not necessarily be lost.
No, this is a completely self-contained adventure that is happening while the ongoing X events are going on. So I would try to touch on it a little verbally through dialogue and script, but part of the entire story structure is young Nate complaining to Cable that they're wasting their time on this side adventure because there's a big thing happening right now and Orcus needs to be addressed. And Cable is temporarily fixated on this particular new problem that he fears will grow into a much bigger problem down the road, and he'd rather nip it in the bud right now.
And I'm assuming the lure having you come back was A, it's Cable, B, it's a miniseries, so you're not tied to a book or anything like that. Is this something that if they were to say, hey, we'd love you to do an ongoing, you've got so much other stuff going on, is it something that you're willing to come back to comics on a miniseries and case-by-case basis, or have they ever approached you to do a more of an ongoing long-term series?
You know what? It hasn't been an issue for me to even be worried about because I haven't been offered a monthly comic. And I honestly don't know if Marvel and DC publish that many monthly comics anymore. I know some of the more popular characters are ongoing, but even they get canceled and relaunched constantly, right? I mean, Dan Slott's not currently writing Amazing Spider-Man number, 800, whatever. He's writing whatever the 50th relaunch of Spider-Man has been. So I don't even think about it. I don't even concern myself. If my editor Lauren Amaro, who's great, she's just been wonderful to work with, and she assembled a great creative team. If Lauren says Marvel's decided they want to keep going, I just say, do they have a set number of issues in mind? Because that gives me an idea how to structure my story. If they go, yeah, we want to go to 12, I'll say, okay, fine. Then I'll write a story to 12. I stopped thinking about monthly comics and writing for monthly comics way back in my Cable and Deadpool days, because we were under a looming guillotine every six issues basically for almost the entire run of that book. So it changed my way of thinking. I didn't want to think long term anymore because I never thought there would be a long term. And I made the cardinal sin of backing away from my new philosophy just a few years later when Mike Marks asked me to come back to write Red Robin after Chris Yost was leaving with issue 12. Mike asked me about, I wanted to come back to write Tim Drake because I had written the last year of the Robin monthly comic. Mm-hmm. And I said I would love to because I love writing Tim Drake. And I actually had that book broken down in my notebook real roughly through multiple arcs up to like issue 75. And then with issue 25, we find out New 52 is going to kill the book. So I'm like, oh, come on. Like, so I that was it. That was absolutely the nail in the coffin for me to even spend energy, spend mental creative energy on trying to think of things as monthly books. You know, just tell me how many issues we're working on and I'll come up with something. If you like it, let's rock and roll, you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I've approached it. So this was a 4-issue miniseries. The first issue is like 25 pages long, and I structured my story to work within that time, that kind of a frame, you know?
Yeah.
And it's good. If they want to do more with this creative team, I would say yes in a second, because I love working with this group. If it's a different artist that I don't like as much, that may make me say no, thank you. You know, mm-hmm. I'm pretty comfortable in that regard right now. That I've said no a few times when they've asked me to do things because I just wasn't excited by it. But oftentimes they'll, you know, some editors that I work with know that usually all they need to do is say one word to me, and that's pretty quick. Like, so when Jordan called me up a few years ago, and he just said Juggernaut, and I was like, yes, it didn't even matter. I didn't even know Ron was drawing the book then. Then this time Jordan called me up and said Cable. And I go, oh, okay, what's going on? I asked some questions this time. I don't want to do a past retro continuity story. I want it to be present continuity. And he goes, absolutely. And I was like, I don't want to get too tied up in a crossover because I'm not a part of the writing group, so it makes it really hard. He goes, well, we may be able to, you know, dance around that. I go, okay, let's figure that out. And we figured that out because we had an email thread going on with Jordan and me and Lauren and Jerry Dugan, and we figured out how this flows because it was going to be really hard to tie it in too tightly to what Jerry was doing. And all I needed to do was leave it at a place where Jerry can pick it up again. And that's exactly what we're doing. So I'm basically taking the baton from them, running along a parallel track, and then handing the baton back to them at the end of it, you know?
And that perfectly answered my next question, which was going to be, you know, how much did you come into with, well, if I'm going to do it, I want to do this, and how much were the editorial team like, well, you can't do this because this, because I know some writers we've talked to recently have said, well, they wanted to do this. Like, we just had DG Chichester on to talk about the Daredevil series, and for some reason there was a character. They said, well, no, you can't use this character. So I didn't know if there was any, you came in with some
ideas.
Oh, that
happens all the time, though. That's constant. That's a constant annoyance, but it's just a reality of working on, work for hire in a collective sandbox. There's sometimes you want to play with a toy and the toy's not available because there's another kid playing with it, or a greedy kid who wants to play with it 6 months from now and won't let you play with it now as a result. That happens all the time, and it's always frustrating if you have a plan. Like my you know, I had a list of characters that I wanted to try to incorporate into the storyline, and I found out a bunch weren't available, so I just had to juggle and play with it a little bit. What ends up happening with me often is I just go back to my comfort zone, which is the Fabianverse. I got a small little group of characters and storylines that I percolated but never fully developed, that have always been around the periphery of stuff, mostly in the X-Books, but some of it in the mainstream Marvel Universe with Thunderbolts and things like that. So I always feel comfortable that if I'm stuck, I can't use this character. That's really going to throw me off for what part three of this 4-part storyline was going to be. I always know that I can fall back on using something that I came up with, that I knew what I wanted to do with it, and that hasn't been played with enough. And I'm comfortable doing that. You know, I that happened here. And so I pull out a couple not so shiny dimes anymore, but they're also not rusted. They can still go in the gumball machine. And then I end up using them. And I did that again here in the Cable miniseries. I'm not allowed to use XYZ because stuff is going on. Okay, fine. What can I do? Who is complementary to that from the standpoint of what the story needs. And Marvel has the truckload of characters that you should be able to find someone who's complementary to what your needs are. Oh, I need a nasty biogeneticist. Okay, I can't use X. Well, I can use Y instead, you know? And I can't use Y. Well, then that's when I go into my pocket and I pull out my Fabian versus Z that no one has used in 10 years, you know? And then I'm good to go.
So we will get to see some surprise appearances in this series, I would think, by members of the Fabianverse?
Yes, absolutely. Two or three at least, yes. One I don't think has been seen since I last wrote them, and that was 30 years ago.
Oh, wow.
One who has been used in the X books, but not recently. And I used a lot way back in the day. Another one who I think hasn't been seen in 10 years at least, who I think is a shame on Marvel's part, because I think this is an excellent, I really like this character a lot, and I'm using them in the way I think they should be used. So you'll see that character in the miniseries, but you won't even know you're seeing that character in the miniseries until the end. And we'll leave it at that. But ultimately, the focus of the book is not all that stuff. That's all, for me, that's all, that's all fun Easter eggs and fun like crunchy bits, like I was saying earlier. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. the focus of the book really is about Cable and Nate, and Cable seeing himself through Nate's eyes and Nate seeing himself through Cable's eyes, and neither one of them really liking all that much what they see. And Cable wanting to be a little more proactive about the problems that they're all facing today, because a problem ignored today becomes a much bigger problem tomorrow, and he's sick and tired of something he could have addressed now cropping up in 10, 20, 30 years to create multiple alternate timelines that are all a disaster area, et cetera, et cetera. And Nate looking at Cable and thinking to himself, I don't want to become that. And even more interestingly, what if this timeline we're trying to stop is a good thing? What if it's worth seeing if this can happen? And therein will lie some of the underlying conflict between them.
And again, the Cable miniseries hits newsstands. I say newsstands, comic book stores. They don't sell them in newsstands anymore, unfortunately. January 17th in 2024. So make sure you make it a New Year's resolution to put that on your pull list. Please ask your local comic book store to order it for you, just to make sure you get your copy with art by, as we mentioned, by Scott Eaton. Anything else you're doing that people can look for you on as far as other projects?
I have one shot coming from Marvel in February, which is a giant size Fantastic Four issue. It's a misnomer, although the issue itself is giant size. My story is regular size, which was quite a little annoying sort of a thing to find out after I agreed to do it. They want to celebrate the 50th anniversary of those great giant size issues from the early 70s.
Oh, yeah.
Of which I have them all in my basement from when I originally bought them. And they told me, I said, how many pages are going to be? 30, 35? And they like looked at me like I was like, I had two heads. They go, no, it's going to be a regular 20-page story. I'm like, what?
Oh.
How do you call it giant size if it's a regular 20-page story? Well, because it's going to have a reprint in the back, and that'll make it giant size. I was like, okay, there you go. Thanks for nothing. I tried to do a story that was kind of in keeping with those great giant size FF issues that came out. Like the first four or five were great. Like mm-hmm. it was Roy Thomas and Jerry Conway and Len Wein and Rich Buckler and John Buscema. And every one of them were self-contained issues that had a big thing in it, big new character, a big storyline. So I wanted to create a new character that could be big. Doesn't mean he will be big, but he could be. I found that I couldn't use Submariner, but they were more than happy to have me write a story that would help bridge the gap between where Submariner currently is and what they're going to do with him next.
Okay.
So I just looked at my tropes for Submariner and I thought to myself, well, they've been saying something for 50 years and I don't know that we've ever fully defined it, and that is Namor shouting Imperius Rex all the time, which in Latin means eternal king or forever king. And I thought to myself, what if it's a shout out to someone? What if the reason that became common lore for Atlanteans is because it was rooted in history, which at this point becomes mythology because it was so long ago.
Right.
And what if there was a character that called themselves the Forever King and they were thought to be the Forever King? And so I basically have this character coming out of a Atlantean Lemurian magical stasis back into present day, and he is Imperius Rex. He is the Forever King, and he's not all that happy with where things stand right now as far as Atlantis and Lemuria are concerned. So he's a character called Matlas, and he is a Lemurian and Atlantean hybrid.
Hmm.
Was their king 4,000 to 5,000 years ago, and during his reign he tried to bring the two people together, and too many of the factions on each of the Atlantean side and the Lemurian side did not want that. They did not want to change their society. They did not want to unify them. They preferred their differences and their hatred of each other because of their differences. So after 100 years of rule, they in essence like betrayed him and basically put him under lock and key. And in the opening of the story, and I got a short stroke the whole story because it's 20 pages long and there's a lot of big stuff. But at the opening of the story, Reed Richards is helping Walt Newell Stingray to do some research in the ocean, and they uncover this giant door hidden by a whole bunch of vegetation and plant life, and of course the two of them want to open the door, and there goes the story from there.
And Walter Newell, one of my very favorite reserve Avengers, that'll be cool to see him pop up again.
Yeah, it's always fun. Yeah, I love breaking out characters like that. I mean, they've used Stingray on and off over the years, and I just always love the costume, although I never understood why it was red and white, but I always loved the costume. And getting to use him, unfortunately I don't get to use Stingray that much. It's as much Walt Newell as anything else within the context of the story.
And anything else besides the giant size FF in February?
Coming a little later in the spring, let's say late spring, maybe early summer, will be the release of my first image book that I'm co-writing with Kurt Busick with art by Stephen Mooney.
Nice.
It's called Free Agents. Solicitations will be coming out soon on it, so I don't want to say too much yet, but it started with as with most things in me writing comics, it starts with a phone call. Kurt called me up and said, do you want to co-write a book with me? And I said, well, I always enjoy working with you, even though it's a tremendous pain in the ass for both of us, so let's do it. And we started percolating an idea that he had a while ago that he wanted to flesh out, and it's basically a group of interdimensional soldiers who have been fighting a gigantic interdimensional multi-plane war their entire lives, and they find themselves trapped on Earth with no war to fight. So what are they going to do? Who are they going to become? And how does that radically change with the unexpected return of someone who is very, very much focused on keeping them prepared for the battle that they inevitably think is going to come to Earth?
So we can look for that in the spring or summer of 2024. For somebody who doesn't write comics very much, you seem very busy in comics right now, which is great.
Well, you know, it's actually interesting. It's an interesting ebb and flow. Like I got the cable call and the giant size FF call a week apart. Like literally out of nowhere. It's like the editorial offices, they're all talking to each other. Oh, I'm gonna use Fabian on this. Oh, that's a good idea. Let me see if Fabian will be interested in doing this issue I got lying around that I don't have anyone to do, you know? And so that happened, you know, that happened the same thing years earlier with the Juggernaut thing. Kurt called me like a week, the same week that Jordan White called me. Jordan's offering the Juggernaut. And this was like, we're talking about like the fall of 2020 or something. Kurt was calling me to see if we wanted to get this started. It's taken years to get free agents going for a wide variety of reasons, not the least of which we weren't going to solicit until we had like at least six issues in the can.
Yeah.
And we're being real smart that way, because I'm really adamant about wanting it to come out on a monthly basis. And in between that, I was working with Riley Brown on my Outrage webtoon comic, and that got delayed for a year because of, you know, issues that we were having with the production of the material. But I've always dabbled. I'm always poking my finger back and forth. If I get a call, I'm interested. I don't pitch. I don't solicit myself to do it. I don't call editors. I haven't written anything for DC in 5 years, I think. But if an editor from DC called me tomorrow, I'd entertain it, depending on who the character is and who the artist is and everything else, you know?
Yeah.
I'm at a really good point in my life and in my career right now where I get to do stuff that is fun and that I'm enjoying, and I get to say no if I feel like saying no. I don't have to do the work, which is great. I don't have to pay a mortgage. I don't have to pay college tuitions anymore. That's all like rearview mirror for me. So I'm just enjoying what I'm doing, and I'm percolating, you know, my third book and my third novel, and I'm percolating television development on Suburban Dicks, and we'll see what happens.
And I'm sitting here in my studio. I'm looking at Suburban Dicks and Self-Made Widow right here in their glorious red and blue slipcases. It's always cool. So hopefully another one of those will be coming. But like I said at the very beginning, whenever I see your name coming on a comic book, I'm always going to make sure that I get a copy, because it's always top-tier stuff. I know you're active on social media. Anything else websites-wise? People want to keep up with you, find out more about you, talk to you directly?
No, I have an author website that I never update, so they'll never get updates from me there, because I got fabianiciesa.com, which I was hoping would be the most misspelled URL on the planet Earth.
Right.
I don't keep up with enough because I'm too damn lazy, but I'm on Twitter all the time. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Blue Sky, and I'm on Instagram, so I'm incredibly easy to get a hold of, and I'm usually pretty open to you know, direct messaging on all of those platforms. And I'll respond if you're not being a jerk. So you can always keep up with whatever it is I'm doing, more so through my social media accounts probably than my own website, because like we've established, I'm an idiot. But I should be using my website as my main focal point, but it's just too much work.
Well, again, I appreciate your time. It's always, always great to talk to you and great to see you at conventions. Hopefully I'll run into you again very soon. And happy new year and happy birthday.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Hope everyone had a happy holiday season. And I look forward to seeing you in 2024.
And just like that, another show has gone. My thanks to both Victor Gishler and Fabian Nesquiza for joining us on New Year's Eve. I want to make sure we tell you very quickly about our premier sponsor, Discover St. Charles. That's discoverstcharles.com. If you're making your New Year's resolution to visit some place you haven't been before, please put St. Charles, Missouri on the top of that list. A lot of cool stuff that's already out there, that's already happening, that's already in the works for 2024 and beyond. More on that coming soon. But you want to make sure you plan your trip. There's always something going on. Great food, great atmosphere, cool stuff to see. If you're a history buff, a foodie, if you like just getting out in the outdoors and hanging out, if you like seeing someplace new, put St. Charles on your list for 2024. Start your trip at the website, discoverstcharles.com. That's going to do it. Happy New Year to all of my listeners. I appreciate all of your support, your downloads, your listening, your calls, your texts, your support throughout the year. It's meant a great deal to myself. And of course, thanks as always to Joey V for making the show sound as good as it does. Wouldn't still be doing this now here going on 7 years, 8 years later without his help. So thanks to Joey V. And thank you to all of you. Until next week, my friends.
It's not in the way you watch I sound.
Thank you, Krakoa. Good night.
Hey, kids. Are your parents about to buy you a shiny new toy from Amazon?
Hi, I'm Chucky. Wanna play?
Well, don't be selfish. Share some of that money with us. Before going on Amazon, make sure to type in bit.ly/geek2me in the web browser. It will look just like Amazon.com, except it'll say referral Geek to Me Radio up top. And then when you check out, a tiny percentage will go to support the show without costing you 1 cent more. So before your parents get you that gizmo, gadget, or widget, make sure they type in bit.ly/geek2me in the web browser.
bit.ly/geek2me, bit.ly/geek2me.